The Guardian.
Welcome back to another Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, I immerse myself deep in the Australian underworld with David Michaud's menacing Melbourne-based crime drama, Animal Kingdom. We abduct Mark Henderson and hold him for ransom until he spills the beans about his documentary My Kidnapper, which sees him revisiting the site of his own abduction in Colombia and turning the camera on his captor. Zan Brooks will be here as we review some of the week's other releases, including the financial meltdown documentary Inside Job, François Truffaut's 1973 classic Day for Night, and we sample the heavenly voice of Justin Bieber. Oh yes, stick around for that. It's an auto-tuned thing of beauty. It's Film Weekly. Think back to films like The Kelly Gang and The Proposition, and you become aware of a rich vein of menacing films about Australian outlaws. But David Michaud's debut feature, Animal Kingdom, is set in present-day Melbourne. It won a record 18 Australian Film Institute nominations earlier this year, telling the story of an explosive criminal family debased by drugs over generations. It also manages to be a twisted kind of love story, featuring veteran Australian actress Jackie Weaver as the family's matriarch, a performance which earned her one of this year's surprise Oscar nominations. There are also terrific brooding turns from Guy Pearce as Detective Leckie and Ben Mendelsohn as Pope. This is truly a very modern drama with a vice-like intensity, as the director himself, David Michaud, told me.
It's kind of a crime film, and in other ways it's like a kind of a family drama mixed with a horror film, which was always my intention. You know, I wanted to make a kind of a sprawling, austere crime film that had a genuine and palpable underlying menace.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the performance you get from Ben Mendelsohn is one of the great menacing performances, simply because he's so, for half of it, he's not menacing at all. You just kind of feel the menace, but you're thinking, well, he's not being threatening at all. He doesn't even look like he's going to harm anyone. And it builds and builds and builds. It's a tremendous, glowering performance that bubbles inside. The poison kind of bubbles up.
I wrote the character for Ben Mendelsohn, and, you know, and especially in my conversations with him, we were quite clear on the fact that what makes his character so dangerous is that he is confused and unstable, and that the most terrifying people in the world don't need to advertise how terrifying they are. And in fact, they most often do the opposite. They do their best to hide their volatility. He doesn't need tattoos. He doesn't need tough outfits and tough haircuts. Yes.
Go get him. And do what? Let him know he's king.
Come on, come outside! I'll dick you, mate! Come outside! Come on, idiot, come outside! Hey! Whoa, 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 brother! Just relax, man, I'm just gonna have a chat to him, alright? Just chill, bro. Fuck this, man. Fuck out of here, man!
Where did the story come from? Because it's a very modern story about Melbourne, and we've seen kind of crime family stories from Australia before. I'm thinking of like the Kelly Gang. I'm even thinking of The Proposition that Nick Cave did. And those are kind of, you know, tight family kind of crime dramas, but obviously they're set kind of in the early days of Australia. It was kind of refreshing to see such a modern film about crime.
It might be a long bow to draw, but whatever form Melbourne's contemporary criminal world takes, you know, has a lineage that stretches back to those days of Ned Kelly, you know, and that to a certain extent Melbourne is generally regarded as the crime capital of Australia, you know, and it has a peculiar fascination with its underworld. And I think it's in part to do with the fact that Melbourne's criminal world isn't confined to particular bad neighbourhoods or ethnic enclaves. It's a criminal fabric that stretches across the city and, you know, and essentially lives next door. I wanted Animal Kingdom to be a semi-sprawling crime drama that charted an entire spectrum of different characters and different moral positions, and I wanted a relative innocent to guide us through. I wanted that character not to be, you know, a kind of cartoon fish out of water. You know, it's quite clear that he comes from an unsavoury background himself, but that he is having to form for himself an identity surrounded by an entire, you know, jungle of different personalities.
I mean, the title's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because there's this kind of Darwinian kind of aspect to it. And there is a law here as well. There's a law going on. There's a kind of pecking order. And, of course, you've got this brilliant lioness figure at the centre of it, one of the kind of great kind of crime women at the centre of it. Tell me about that figure, and that actress is not one I was familiar with.
Well, Jackie Weaver is something of a national treasure back in Australia. You know, I wrote her character for her. I offered her the part many years ago. Jackie was around at that, in the 70s, the Australian cinema renaissance. She was in Peter Weir's Picnic at Hanging Rock and a number of other Australian films of that period. She doesn't really do that many movies anymore.
Well, she worked with Weir, and she's worked with that whole early kind of Breaker Morant things and all that.
Yeah, I think she won an AFI award for a film called Caddy. She doesn't do that many movies anymore, and I don't think it's by choice. She's on stage 365 days a year, and this character is so kind of complex and so dark. I wanted it to be performed by an actor of Jackie's talent, but also an actor of Jackie's mischief.
There's a Shakespearean quality to this character, I would say, because, she's kind of conducting it all, really. She's directing it all.
Yeah, on a certain level, it would appear that she is a matriarch of this family, and yet, to an extent, she's not really controlling these boys. What she's doing, in a way, is just simply, she's like the self-appointed centre of the family. Mm. You know, she is the glue that holds these boys together. You know, boys who probably wouldn't be hanging around one another if it weren't for her and her strangely inappropriate love for them.
Yeah. I thought she was a terrific creation. I mean, is this a world you know yourself? Because it's tempting as a first-time filmmaker to kind of make it up and just kind of go, well, I've completely invented it. Or is it something you researched and looked at kind of and dealt with a kind of method directing, if you like, or is it kind of, let's just use our imaginations?
I did a lot of research with a guy named Tom Noble, who used to be the chief police reporter at the Age newspaper in Melbourne, who just had a wealth of just general material, just to give a certain authentic flavour to the certain kind of cops and robbers machinations of the film. But, for me, at the end of the day, any kind of authenticity that sits at the centre of the film is entirely about truthful observation of human behaviour.
It's interesting that the cast you assemble as well. I mean, you talk about Jackie Weaver there, but Joel Edgerton, Ben Mendelsohn, and of course Guy Pearce, kind of the A-list now of kind of Australian film talent, just, having the next generation from the Cate Blanchetts and the Hugo Weavings that you mentioned there. Guy Pearce in particular, who's in the King's Speech at the moment playing, King Edward, Mrs. Simpson kind of thing, and then, he's off in Hollywood. Is he based in Australia? He always seems to go back to support an Australian film when he can.
Well, he lives in Melbourne, and I think he likes working at home. But, at the same time, he would be reading a lot of stuff. Mm. And I found it very encouraging that he responded to us very quickly and very enthusiastically. I mean, he was my first choice for that character. And when he said yes and said yes quickly, it was a much-needed vote of confidence.
Yeah, I can imagine. Good moustache, too.
He's a guy who's hanging on to some old sense of what it means to be a cop, when all the other cops around him are seemingly working against him.
It gives him some kind of menace as well. The moustache kind of, it hides, it bristles, it kind of can do all sorts of things. So there is a kind of menace there, but there's also a warmth to it as well. He's your counterpoint to your Ben Mendelsohn character, because there's a danger to Guy Pearce always, even just coming on screen, there's a danger to him. He could be psychopathic, he could be kind of for the good, and I think that's a very nice kind of late yin and yang opposition that's set up there.
Yeah, I love that, to the extent that Ben Mendelsohn and Guy Pearce are sort of Animal Kingdom's polar moral opposites. I love the fact that they are also, as people, very different personalities, And one of the beautiful things about Guy is that he can be difficult to read, I like that. There's a certain mysteriousness there, whereas one of Ben's great qualities is his unpredictability.
The other thing about your film, there was the witness protection program that sort of comes in and stuff. And I thought to myself, God, I don't know who your influences are. Are they Australian as a filmmaker, or are they American crime films as a kind of influence? And I kind of thought at first, the moment when I thought of it, it reminded me of Goodfellas in a kind of good way. Pretty good film to be reminded of. The sort of tone and the progression of it reminded me of Goodfellas, the pace of it.
I mean, I think Animal Kingdom is a very different film. Goodfellas moves at a clip, and it has a levity about it. Whereas Animal Kingdom is a very measured, slow-burning menacing crime film, and one that takes itself very seriously, you know.
There's a bit that reminds me of Michael Mann as well, at his best as well, which I think is, you know, kind of, these are all good things to be reminded of. And I thought it was a terrific debut. Not just a terrific debut, terrific film, David. So congratulations on that. Really wish you the best of luck with it, whatever happens to Animal Kingdom and whatever happens to your career from now on. But do come back on Film Weekly with your second film. So David Michaud, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And one of the most powerful films around, Animal Kingdom, goes on nationwide release here in the UK from Friday the 25th of February. We'll be reviewing it on Film Weekly next week. Talking of animals, with 4 days of stubble, looking like a feral baboon, wearing his battered DJ from the BAFTAs, it's none other than our very own Zan Brooks. How are you?
I don't think I've ever had a nicer introduction than that, Jason. Thank you. Hello.
You survived the BAFTAs.
I survived it. I don't know if it survived me. I almost got kind of bundled off into the gutter by Emma Watson's security
goons. Does she have burly minders?
She has very burly minders, you know, and I kind of thought maybe that's a sort of, it's a metaphor for my relationship with Harry Potter films right there and then.
They knew. It's that Brooks. Yeah. He's a muggle.
Apart from that.
Was that as close as you got to glamour?
It really was. The security goon's armpit is as close as I ever get.
Oh, poor Zan. What do you think about it? Jonathan Ross, by the way, I mean, I know one's kind of host to another, but he was rubbish.
Well, he was definitely steering away from the Ricky Gervais route, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, by just being really rubbish.
Yeah.
Not dangerous, bland, I just thought bland.
But the whole thing was kind of bland.
He did a couple of gags that I'd rejected.
Oh, like, you'd rejected? I'd wow. Do,
well, you know, that's how bad.
Wow, that's low.
Like Colin Firth, don't do your acceptance speech in character because we have the time. Just a terrible gag.
Yeah, but to be fair, they're probably not written by him anyway, are they?
Yeah, but so you have the power of veto, as in don't open your bloody mouth.
I guess you do. Yes. And there were a lot of no shows as well. No Natalie Portman, no David Fincher, no Jeffrey Rush. That's not good either, is it?
No, but he was on stage in Melbourne or something.
Yeah, that's
Jeffrey
the
Rush.
Oldest excuse in the book, that, isn't it?
I'm always on stage in Melbourne when I'm not available. It's the Coventry of theatre.
Yeah, you know he's just sitting at home on the couch with, like, Doritos. Watching Jeremy Kyle.
Yes. Zan, shall we talk about the films that are coming out this week?
Yes, let's do that.
All right, then. Well, first up, we're going to talk about Inside Job. Then you can talk to me about Confessions. Mm-hmm. And then we'll also talk about La Nuit Américaine or Day for Night, one of those great translated French titles that don't translate because it actually is not really about American Night. Well, we'll talk about why.
Yeah, let's explain it.
That's Truffaut, by the way. But we'll start with Inside Job, an Oscar-nominated documentary with Matt Damon doing the narration. It's directed by Charles Ferguson, and the film looks into the financial meltdown of 2008, tracing the rise of what he calls a rogue industry and the way that banking has tainted politics, morality, and academia.
Share prices continued to tumble.
Lehman Brothers was forced to declare itself bankrupt.
The largest single point drop.
The regulators, they had the power to do every case that I made when I was state attorney general. They just didn't want to.
We are watching this tsunami coming.
They were having massive private gains at public loss.
The financial engineer built dreams. When those dreams turn out to be nightmares, other people pay for it.
Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, they knew what was happening.
What do you think about selling securities which your own people think are crap? Does that bother you
as a hypothetical?
No, this is real.
Bankers, Zan, hey, you got to love them.
Do you?
Can you after
Can
this?
Can you? After this and Michael Moore's Capitalism, a Love Story from last year. This is very much not going the Michael Moore route. This is much more of a straight forensic journalistic investigation.
A bit more of an Errol Morris route, it seemed to me, in some kind
it
of
is,
way.
I guess, but it lacks sort of Errol Morris's strangeness. Mm. It's very much up front. This is basically him going into all these palatial ballrooms and interviewing the culprits, basically, and getting them to justify themselves and express remorse if they can bring themselves to do so.
Which that's kind of the main thing of the film, is that they really can't even see, most of them, that they've done anything wrong whatsoever.
Not at all. Not at all. And which leads the film, I think, almost intentionally towards a kind of impasse, that there's no actual answers here.
Mm.
It's explaining it. It goes right back to the 1980s and shows how the financial system, the whole markets were basically kind of deregulated,
yes.
spearheaded largely by Alan Greenspan.
Yeah, and Ronald Reagan.
And Ronald Reagan.
Who appointed, I didn't know this, he appointed someone, I think, to the Treasury called Donald Reagan.
Yeah.
So at one point there was Ronald Reagan and Donald Reagan.
Yeah, it's like sort of the Mickey Mouse. it's a Disney film you really don't want to see.
Brilliant. I knew they were stupid, but I didn't know it was that silly.
And then leads us obviously through, you know, banks gambling with investors' money, the whole subprime bubble, the whole
derivatives,
all
of
that.
You kind of toss this off as if you're completely au fait with.
I'm not at all, but then nobody's au fait with derivatives, because derivatives, by their nature, are so fiendishly, infernally complex that they're almost a kind of chimera that's created so it can bypass any kind of regulation.
They're like financial MacGuffins in this kind of Hitchcockian mystery that's going on.
And this does very well in explaining, I guess, the unexplainable. And there's no real answers to this, but what it does do is expose a terribly kind of frighteningly cozy relationship between government, between banks, and between academia, to the extent that you think this corruption is utterly endemic. It goes through everything, because the gatekeepers, or who are supposed to be the gatekeepers, are themselves criminals.
Yes, well, you've got Columbia Business School and Harvard Business School, and they're producing graduates who go and work on Wall Street and fuel Wall Street, and they're all being taught by these
deans. And the professors have little kind of sweet backhand deals to advise.
Yeah, little. I mean, come on, them like £1 million, $1 million consulting, writing books on Iceland, saying Iceland's very good. Go to Iceland, it's brilliant. And it's not. And, you know, one of them's called Larry Summers, I noticed, who, interestingly, features playing him in The Social Network. He plays the dean of Harvard, where the Winklevi twins go to him and sort of ask, and he kind of goes, well, you know, I'm Secretary of the Treasury, I know about money. And it's very interesting to see him kind of also being completely skewered in Inside
Job. Yeah, so he's not going to be going to the Oscars, is he?
I don't think so.
No.
I mean, do you think that the film actually skewers enough people? Or is it just my bloodlust? I wanted to see these people sort of hanging themselves.
Well, it's a sober and sobering film. It's not out to flame these people, but the evidence of it is certainly compelling. And I guess Charles Ferguson, who made obviously No End in Sight a couple of years ago, his argument would be, what can you do apart from expose them and ask them these questions? And then I guess the rest of it is up to us.
Because it's interesting, because he can't really sort of say, well, you did this wrong, because obviously they've changed all the laws to make everything they do completely right. But what he's sort of saying, but there's a sort of a morality. And I like the way that he kind of interviewed a kind of rather pneumatic madame who kind of said, well, you know, she had like 10,000 prostitutes at the behest of Wall Street. And so it is that endemic thing that you were talking about. The morality is everywhere, corrupting absolutely. But what he was in the end saying was that, well, what you do is immoral. Your job is immoral, basically. Please admit that. And that's why they can't really see it, because there are thousands of people employed on Wall Street and they all work in money.
Yeah.
And it's so what you're saying, what we're doing is wrong.
Well, it's almost like dropping in on an alien planet, isn't it? Their morality is different from ours. Mm. And so to actually get them to see it the way we see it is almost like it's the sort of the unbridgeable gap. They're never going to do it, because if they did, their world would implode. And yet, of course, their world has imploded.
So you sit there with, as I guess most people would, or I do, with a slightly sort of left-leaning kind of sense of anger about all this, because the 1% in America getting richer and everyone else is getting poorer. But you could just view, if you were one of them, you'd be in that bubble. You'd be thinking, well, am I doing anything wrong? I mean, I've not done anything illegal. I went to Harvard. I got a nice job. And now I've got a Ferrari. Of course, this all works. It makes sense for me.
Well, this is the immovable object of the film, isn't it? I mean, these people are never going to see the error of their ways because they've been steeped in this culture for so long that is entirely who they are. The only answer, I guess, is to overthrow the whole system and start anew.
Which is what Michael Moore was sort of suggesting.
Yes,
he was going to arrest the whole lot. He kind of
cellophane. Yeah, he had the crime scene tape, didn't he, around Wall Street.
Yeah.
Charles Ferguson doesn't sort of play that game. It's much more of a, you know, it's documentary 1.0, really. It's like, here is the evidence. Here is me putting the questions to these 40-odd interview subjects in their vast offices looking out over the city. The rest of it, that's our call.
Yeah, I kind of wanted Oliver Stone to do it in Wall Street 2, Money Never Sleeps, but he sort of completely backed out, because he too was kind of like, well, you're all evil, but my God, you've got nice cars.
Well, that's always been the problem of Oliver Stone, isn't it? That he's sort of seduced as much by what he's repulsed by. So then you get this sort of terrible fudge. This is much more of a clean, clinical film.
Yes, a clear-eyed documentary. Will it win the Oscar, do you think?
I don't think so.
Well, there's three Brits. Tim Hetherington's Restrepo.
Yes, that's right, which is very good.
Lucy Walker's Wasteland, out next week,
yep,
which we'll review here. You've got Josh Fox, a guest on this show, with his banjo for Gasland. Well, oh, Banksy, of course.
Banksy, yeah. I'm kind of going for Restrepo, I think, because I think that that's, you know, the Academy voters will like that because it's a serious thing about the issue of our time. War, and maybe not as complicated as Wall Street.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose
compromised.
But it is the issue of, they do like a film that's sort of current and urgent and relevant.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of these people, you know, we're talking about academia, the banks and the government, but, you know, Hollywood is kind of steeped in that as well.
It's pretty close as well, isn't it? You could do the same with
it's Hollywood. A little bit biting the hand that feeds.
I kept thinking I thought about the left-leaning anger that one has with that. I also thought that other maxim about how the rich are different to you and I, they've got more money.
They've got more money, and it's the old adage of, you know, it's the free market for all of us, but it's socialism for the rich, that when they fall over, the government is there to pick them up with public money.
Didn't it just? Angry now, Zan, angry. Should we sort of treat into a masterpiece from 1973?
Let's do that.
Well, let's discuss whether it's a masterpiece or not. It is the re-release of a film within a film by François Truffaut. It's his 1973 classic Day for Night, or in French, La Nuit Américaine, in which a film director struggles to finish a masterpiece as a series of crises afflict him.
Vous savez, vous pouvez tout à fait rassurer pour Julie.
Oui. Elle est très heureuse sur ce film. Je suis sûr qu'il tiendra le coup.
C'est étonnant, hein, comme les acteurs sont vulnérables.
Non, c'est normal. Tout le monde a peur d'être jugé. Mais dans votre métier, le jugement fait partie de la vie, dans le travail et en dehors du travail.
Eh oui. Dès que nous rencontrons quelqu'un, nous nous demandons qu'est-ce qu'il pense de moi. Est-ce qu'il m'aime? Oh, je pense que c'est la même chose pour tous les artistes.
A film dedicated at the beginning to the sisters Lillian and Dorothy Gish. I don't quite know why, because Truffaut's quite pretentious.
I don't know why either. It's like the Lars von Trier dedicating Antichrist to Tarkovsky, isn't
it? Exactly. At least that came at the end. The opening scene of Day for Night, hugely influential, influenced Robert Altman doing The Player, for example. And probably taken in its inspiration from something like Orson Welles' A Touch of Evil. It's an amazing scene where they're trying to kind of get the shot, and we realise it's a film within a film quite early on.
Yeah, it's this huge town square with everybody milling around, and they're all extras, basically, and they're all choreographed, and then they have to do it again. And it does, I mean, and that's basically the film in essence,
exactly,
right there.
Do we need to see more of the film?
I think we do. Yeah. I'd never actually seen this before. I loved it and was irritated by it, and then eventually won over by it. It's Truffaut's love letter to, you know, the artificial magical world of the movie set
du
where
cinema.
Yeah, where everybody is sort of acting out or having breakdowns and toppling in and out of bed with each other, you know, as these actor types do.
I like films within films. I like musicals that are about backstage dramas. I think they kind of work. I mean, they're always incredibly indulgent. But I mentioned The Player there as well, which I think kind of really owes a debt to this film. But we love them, don't we? They're kind of satiric, and yet they're also kind of noble in their
own. I wonder if we love them because we watch a lot of films.
Yeah, we do, in a way.
You know, maybe other people would just find it just purely irritating. And there's certainly an air of that in there. It's very much within the goldfish bowl, and this is how we are, and we love cinema. And there's a lot of slightly obvious kind of line. You know, there's one character who says, "I would leave a man for a film, but never the other way around."
Yeah.
And there's all these little mission statements kind of dropped in there.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's one that says, "Films are smoother than life. Films are like trains; they glide on."
Yeah.
And this is a phrase that Godard completely fell out with Truffaut over this film. He hated this film. I think it was because Truffaut had Jacqueline Bisset in his film and Godard probably rather fancied her and couldn't get her.
Possibly. And apparently Truffaut's first choice was Jean Seberg, that he wanted Jean Seberg for the Jacqueline Bisset role, who's the sort of the English-speaking star who comes in. I think Jean Seberg would have been better. I found Jacqueline Bisset maybe the kind of weak link in this. She's almost, I know she's supposed to be this sort of blank beauty that people project things on, but she was almost a bit too blank.
Yeah, she was beautiful though.
She's certainly very beautiful, but you know, is that what it's all about?
Well,
in the world of the cinema,
well, kind of in a way, because then you've got Jean-Pierre Léaud in there as well, over whom Godard and Truffaut also fell out. I'm kind of quoting a lot from The Two in the Wave, the film that's currently out at the moment about their friendship, Godard and Truffaut's friendship. And Léaud was kind of pulled between the two of them, even though he was definitely a Truffaut muse. And I think he's rather brilliant in this film.
He's great, isn't he? He's the sort of jittery, lovelorn actor who's dumped and is kind of having a breakdown, basically. There's other people having a breakdown as well. There's a great Valentina Cortese in as the sort of aging diva,
yes,
who keeps fluffing her lines and opening the cupboard door when she's supposed to be getting out of the set. And, and that's a sort of extended scene that starts out comedic and then just becomes more and more painful.
Well, it starts out funny, she has a little glass of champagne and then she finishes the entire bottle before she's going to open the door.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some lovely details in it like that. And it looks really cool still. It's set in Nice in 1973 where they're making this film. So there's all that, it's got that kind of Riviera chic going on.
And a kind of contemporaneous as well, that Truffaut is in there playing the film director and he's complaining that the Godfather's on everywhere. Yeah. There's no other films that are showing because it's all the Godfather.
Exactly. Is it about anything more than like cinema can obsess us all? I mean, in a way, it's kind of got a red
shoe. See, Truffaut would object to that, wouldn't he? Because he'd just say, what is more than cinema can obsess us all? Because that's life.
Exactly. No, he can object to it at all, as he likes. I mean, I'm asking it as a sort of devil's advocate.
No, but I think I do. I would say that that's a moot point.
Mm.
If it draws you in and you laugh at these characters and then feel for them, then that works.
I absolutely loved it. I actually happened to see it with Philip French, who at one point when it finished, you know, you mentioned those books that are in there. He said,
"I actually contributed to one of those books. I'm in one of those books."
He's actually in one of the books.
He's in one of those books. Wow, essay by him. Philip, he's in one of the books in La Nuit Américaine. Incidentally, it's called La Nuit Américaine. Well, and I'd always wondered why this was. I didn't know that the French for shooting day for night, i.e. when you have a day scene and you shoot a day scene, a night scene during the day, quite why you'd want to do that I don't know. But you need a day for night lens when you do that. It's called in French shooting it en nuit américaine.
Yeah, I didn't know that until I watched this.
No, neither did I. So
he teaches us still. Something, you know, he's been dead 25 years and he still teaches.
Francois, we owe you a lot. That's Dave and I would go and see that if I were you.
Yeah, I think it's great.
Yeah, well, not if I were you because you've seen it.
Oh, there's Graham Greene in it as well. Should we mention Graham Greene?
Oh, big fan of
a very kind of awkward little cameo from Graham Greene as the insurance man who says, "I can't back this film anymore." Who Truffaut didn't actually know was Graham Greene when he was playing the role. No, he only found it out afterwards. Very strange.
How did you know that?
I read it up on it.
Philip French's biography.
His Brighton Rock is being introduced as we speak. So good. Zan, you went to see a Japanese movie called Confessions, which I didn't go and see. That's my confession, is that I go and see it. So tell me about it.
Confessions was, interestingly, this was Japan's official entry for this year's Best Foreign Film Oscar.
Didn't
and they won
good.
A couple of years ago for Departures,
yes,
which was a very sort of sweet-natured little comedy about the funeral trade.
Yeah.
This isn't sweet-natured at all. And you kind of think, how could they get it so spectacularly wrong?
Because Departures shocked everyone when it won, apart from you.
It did, but the evidence seems to suggest that the Academy voters, in voting for foreign language films, like them to be slightly kind of tame and sweet
they
and
do.
Nice. This isn't at all. This is a sort of very icy, nihilistic revenge thriller, I guess, about a teacher whose 4-year-old daughter has been found dead in the school swimming pool.
Oh.
And she sits her kind of rowdy students down and then explains what happened and said, "And I know that two of you in this classroom were responsible for her death, and I have spiked your free school milk with HIV-infected blood."
Blimey.
And then we go from there, and it's
like, God,
like
Margaret Thatcher never saw this.
I know. What else? What more damage could she have done? Well, now we know. And it sort of proceeds from there. There's sort of flashbacks. It's very much going for the sort of misanthropic, woozy air.
Yeah, because the clips I've seen are lots of schoolgirls and boys kind of going, you know, in that Japanese school kind of girl kind of way. And I thought, it looks like Battle Royale a bit.
A little bit like that. It's not quite as taut and tight and high concept as Battle Royale. It's possibly a little bit overcooked. There's too much sort of ambient music and slow motion shots of raindrops and storm clouds gathering. And about halfway through, I was really going along with it. And then halfway through, it just gets a little bit over-tortured and a bit sort of swampy. And there's some sort of ridiculous sort of plot twists that kind of snap you out of the film. So it's not as good as I was hoping, like, half an hour in.
Right. I went to see a film that's also got it's set in an educational establishment.
Mm.
It's called Big Mamas, Like Father, Like Son, starring Martin Lawrence as Big Mama, Hattie Mae Pierce. Most people call him Big Mama.
And this has got Philip French in it as well.
It has. But you can't recognise him.
No.
Because he's dressed.
Well, he's method. He goes the full method.
He goes
with
deep.
This.
But it has got his son in it.
He plays Beulah, the housemaid.
He goes undercover. They go undercover because they have to dress up as Big Mamas.
Mm.
And they go to, well, his son dresses up as a sort of fattish kind of woman. And they go to a girls' arts school for the performing arts. Obviously, girls wander around in their bras a lot, which is brilliant. And they go undercover. for no reason. And the whole point of the film is that they should go undercover to reclaim this memory stick, which is hidden inside a music box, which would then inculcate some Russian oligarch, who's actually played by Tony Curran, the bloke from Red Road, you know?
This is graduated.
This is what happens. You kind of do a bit enough Andrea Arnold movies, you go, yeah. I better get to Hollywood and be in some rubbish. And he certainly is in this. They're FBI. He's an FBI agent. Why can't he just go up to the school and go, I'm going to search your music room for the music box, please, because I'm FBI.
Yeah, you'd think, but presumably this is tapping into a far deeper pathology that Martin Lawrence has, that, you know, basically he just wants to dress up as Big Mama.
I want to get my fat suit on. Yeah.
And it's now that's in his contract. That, you know, if he was playing, you know, Lear, he'd probably do it as Big Mama now.
Well, that would make more sense than this. I mean, that would be actually kind of, you could work that into the plot. There's no reason for it. They don't have to go undercover at all.
Right.
I'm reminded of the Wayans movie, White Chicks, where they dress up as white chicks, which actually I think is a rather genius kind of piece of film. This is terrible, by the way. Obviously, it's called Big Mamas, like Father, like Son, and it's terrible. I just thought I should mention that I'd seen it, because otherwise I've completely wasted my time watching it. So I'm sharing that with
you. All right, thanks for warning me. I was just about to book my ticket.
Yeah, as if the kind of the plot points were the main thing. But I just thought, at least make an effort here to go undercover for a reason. Azan, I'm not going to let you go, however. Big Mama's House is not the kind of...
The Nadir.
It's not the Nadir of today. Because there's a film out called Never Say Never. Now, this stars a small-town brat-turned-bowl-hair-dude, auto-tuned wunderkind. His name is Justin Bieber. Have you heard of him?
I have heard of him.
Have you heard him, though?
Should we hear him now?
I need to hear him. I need you to hear him.
Then you'll be a believer, as they say.
That's terrible. Well, now we've heard some Justin Bieber. Really?
I thought that was absolutely brilliant.
Isn't it good?
Mm.
What do you think is going to happen when his voice breaks?
Well, isn't that happening already?
I thought it's because I saw him on the Brits the other night,
yeah.
And he looked a bit sort of older.
I guess he just goes sort of Ozzy Osbourne route, doesn't he?
Really biting the heads off bats.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Can't wait for that. I didn't see the film Never Say Never. I nearly did, and I just thought, you know what? No, I'm not going to. I'm going to play some Bieber on the show, and really that's about it.
I think if you are... in the parlance, a believer, you're going to go and see this, whatever we said, anyway, aren't you? You know, there's no point.
It's done huge business in America.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely huge. $30 million in its first weekend.
What is his USP, do you feel?
He's small and he sings like a rodent.
Yeah, but the Chipmunks did that.
They did, and Gnomeo and Juliet did Crocodile Rock much better last week. As we know, we're big fans of the Gnomeo and Juliet here. Zan, I'm stunned that we've both managed to talk about Martin Lawrence and Bieber and Truffaut.
And Philip French,
all in one brilliant review section.
Let's see if we can shoehorn them all in again next week.
Zan, for your reviews, live blogging is still up for your BAFTA, so can we see what you did there?
Yeah, the terrible entrails of that evidence are still strewn all over the site.
Brilliant. Well, go to that site. It's guardian.co.uk/film. In 2003, Mark Henderson was one of 8 backpackers taken hostage by Marxist rebels in the Colombian jungle. His capture lasted 101 days until both he and the others were released. And for most of us, that is where our connection with our captors would end. But some 10 months after this release, Mark received an email from one of his kidnappers. And this is the story behind his documentary released this week, My Kidnapper. And I'm delighted to say that I've got Mark in the studio with me to tell me more. Welcome to Film Weekly, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And congratulations on My Kidnapper. I kind of feel sort of bad about congratulating you on having been kidnapped and then making your ordeal into a movie.
I know. And I kind of feel bad about constantly reliving it. But, you know.
What was the impetus that made you say, do you know what, I've got to turn this into a film? Or were you always thinking that even when you were in captivity?
I mean, there were a few things. I mean, I suppose I worked in television. I still work in television as well. And so when I was released, a lot of TV companies got in touch with me, wanted to kind of make it into a documentary. Mm. But I think it was just going to be an interview with me and lots of reconstruction. It didn't really interest me. Then I thought about writing a book. That didn't get anywhere. And in fact,
it's hard, isn't it?
Yeah, it is really hard. But also just the process of going back over everything kind of brought a lot up. And I started to kind of it was a form of post-traumatic stress disorder. So I decided, you know what, put that aside and I'll leave it. And then the kidnapper, Antonio, got in touch with me by email. And actually, he brought it up. He brought up the idea of a documentary because we'd spoken about this up in the mountains. I think as a way of getting in with them, with ingratiating myself, you know, of kind of being on their side as such, I always suggested to them, said, look, why don't I come back and make a documentary about, you know, your lives and what you're fighting for? You know, as soon as I left, as soon as I got on the helicopter, there's like, no way am I ever coming back here. But when he brought it back up again, we started the dialogue and it kept on going for five years.
About that movie idea. It's a really strange pitch meeting you had.
I know. It does sound really
Harvey
strange.
Weinstein has been known to kind of pin people down for 100 days and not let them leave.
Yeah, exactly.
But I suppose this is rather different. Remind me the day that you got that email that it received from, you know, Antonio. That he had your email address? How did he find you? How can any kidnappers find their
there's not a listing of us somewhere. No, I'd met up with the priest who negotiated our release and a lot of the negotiations done by the Catholic Church in Colombia. And I'd met up with him for dinner about 6 months later, and he'd said...
In the UK,
yeah. He was over on a business trip. He's Colombian. And right at the end of dinner, he said, there's somebody from the mountains that wants to get in touch with you. And I thought, well, who can it be? Because I'm in touch with all the other hostages. You know, we email regularly. I hadn't seen them at that point again, but we were in contact. And then he said it was one of the kidnappers, and almost immediately I knew which one it would be. Mm-hmm. Because of all the kidnappers, he was the one that I'd really struck up a relationship with. I gave the priest my email address and thought I would hear from Antonio, and it didn't. It was another 5 months before it did. So actually, when the email came through, it was a bit of a surprise. And one of the first things that goes to your head is like, what do I do with this? What am I supposed to do with this? Am I supposed to hand this into the police? Am I supposed to phone the Colombian ambassador? You know, I don't know. But I thought, I mean, it intrigued me more than anything. I wanted to know why he was in touch with me. But also, suddenly there was this man out there that could give me information about elements of the kidnap that I didn't know the answers to. So, you know, it was more intrigue.
The moment you thought, right, I'm going back there, and you got your stuff together. I'm reminded of Aaron Ralston or James Franco in 127 Hours, who just goes off somewhere. That you must have been tempted not to tell anyone where you were going, because no one were going to say, yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, unfortunately, when you're making a documentary about it, you need to tell quite a lot of people. Right. And also because some of our funding came from the BritDoc Foundation, which is related to Channel 4. So we had to go through a lot of, not health and safety, but just making sure that we were safe.
Yeah, those girls at BritDoc, they're very sort of pastoral about their care, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they were obviously concerned about us. And, you know, you have hostile environment courses that you can go on, and you can do these through the BBC and Channel 4 and stuff like that. But actually, they said, you know, there's no use you going on. You've actually, whatever we're going to teach you, you know already. You've already been through it.
Mark Henderson was taken at gunpoint along with six other tourists. Another British man, Matthew Scott, escaped.
Matthew Scott jumped off a cliff and into a river.
The seven tourists still kidnapped are a German, a Spaniard. The military has mounted a full-scale manhunt.
Little is known of Mark's precise whereabouts.
Coming back from making the film and going back to meet Antonio, I would say it wasn't just coming back from there. It was also after the process of editing. And, you know, it's like a four-month process. And so you're going over and over again, everything. And looking back at the interviews, especially the interview we did with Antonio, you know, when you just meet someone and you just have one chance to chat to them, then all you have is that memory. I actually had, you know, 7 hours worth of footage that I watched and watched and watched. And I saw every nuance of his replies and every time he stuttered over a word. And kind of I could really read into what he was trying to get through to us. So the process of actually making the film has really helped me just move on. And also I now have a tangible product as such. I understand now why people write books about horrific things that happen to them, because then you can say, look, that's what happened to me, and you can put it in the past physically.
Put it away. The other thing you can do with this is presumably send it to Antonio in Colombia.
I already have.
And the reaction?
Of course, he wrote back to me and said, why do you include certain elements and why did you not include certain elements?
Yeah, it was all about you. He's like...
yeah, exactly. But also in that same email, he wrote back and he said, I want to apologise again to your parents. You know, I've now seen and listened to their words or read their words, and I now know what they went through.
So this is the human fallout from a political act, which is what the fascinating play of the film is, really, because you're caught up in a political act and greater political machinations. That's the sort of message that comes out of the film. There's a kind of existential kind of penumbra to this film, isn't there? That you are sort of puppets in a game that neither of you really can in control of.
No, exactly. And the thing is, we went back. There was four of us, four hostages went back. We met with Antonio. We met with the army, we met with the priests in negotiation, we met with everyone. And what I was fascinated in was, you know, not this one thing happened to all of us, and it was how the fallout of that for everyone, and actually how most people, you know, their lives either haven't moved on or it's actually for the worst what's happened. Mm.
presumably when you were the backpacker and you went travelling off and you're kind of, you know, with your Lonely Planet and all that, and you Birkenstocks.
Which is exactly what I was
like. Of course you did. And you were like, oh, brilliant, all the locals, how marvellous.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
How did you feel now towards those lovely locals and indigenous tribes that you went to get so down with when you went backpacking?
Well, exactly. I mean, when you go backpacking, they're just people that you take photographs of. And I can remember I met someone when I was actually on this trip. I'd been away for like 5 months. And she said, look, all we do is we're just holiday makers in other people's misery, taking photos of the poorest thing you can find. And that, you know, you look at a lot of backpackers in India and South America, and that's a lot of the time that's what they're doing. You don't want to go to the affluent places because it's very much like the place you've come from. We really saw the other side of Colombia when we went back, because we met a group of women who supposedly we were being held for them. The kidnap was to raise awareness of human rights violations against not just this village, but all the villages in that area. And, you know, just talking to those women, you realise there's a whole other side to Colombia and just stories that you don't read about. You know, they're a footnote in Lonely Planet.
Mm.
And it certainly made me really kind of think, you know, there's more to somewhere than just what you read in the history section of The Lonely Planet or the current affairs section of The Lonely Planet.
Having been kidnapped for a cause, Mark, are you now any closer to understanding what that cause is or being sympathetic to it?
I mean, I was, to an extent, sympathetic to it at the time.
Yeah, I mean, even that's why you were backpacking, presumably, because you wanted to be part of the rebel. Everyone wants to be. It's all Woody Allen and bananas, yeah, isn't it? And Che Guevara.
I mean, yeah, exactly. And it very much was. I mean, they were like walking cliches sometimes. Sometimes a new commandante would turn up and he literally had the wispy beard, the beret, and, you know, the flak jacket. It was ridiculous. But and sometimes I think they were living a very romanticised view of rebellion in South America. And I think half of them didn't even know what they were fighting for. And even Antonio, you know, admits that now. He did have a romantic idea of what being a guerrilla meant. Actually, the practicality of it, the reality of it, living in these mountains, living as we did for those 3 months, is horrendous. Yeah. You know, they've got no food, it's freezing. We were constantly on the move, they're constantly on the move whenever.
And green, it's no colour to be wearing constantly, is it?
Well, you just blend in, but I suppose that's the idea, isn't it? Yeah. That's one of the ideas of the film, is that, you know, he is a kidnapper. And to everyone, it's this faceless kidnapper. And actually, underneath it all, there's a person.
It's a fascinating tale. Congratulations on getting through making it into a movie. Because in a way, that's an ordeal as much as anything as reliving the memory. I know it's safer in an edit suite as well. But I do think there is you have to mine it and be brave and kind of turn this material into your life story. So congratulations on that, Mark Henderson. Thank you very much for coming into Film Weekly to tell us about it.
Thank you. Cheers.
And My Kidnapper is on release. See what I did there? Now. That's all for this week. The music we've been featuring on the podcast is the score to Animal Kingdom, the music by Anthony Partos. It won Best Original Score at the Australian Film Institute Awards last year, one of 10 awards that eventually went that film's way. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for my trailer trash column and a little bit of an Oscar preview panel going on. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer this week, Ian Chambers, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.